I'm Ross Reynolds. Welcome to StoryCorps from New Holly. In this hour, seven interviews recorded at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood in the summer of 2015. Stories about adoption, family, freedom, berry picking. But first, a love story.
My name is Ed Murray. I am 60 years old, which is amazing to me. And I am with my husband, Michael Shiozaki.
Hi, I'm Michael Shiozaki, and I'm 54 years old, and I am married to Ed Murray.
So yesterday, we celebrated our 24th anniversary of the day we met and the second anniversary of our legal marriage, and it has been quite a journey.
So it has been quite a journey. I think when we met 24 years ago, I never would have guessed this is where life would lead us, that today we'd be married and you'd be mayor and I'd be first gentleman, as I'm referred to. I mean, it has been an amazing journey. When we met at Mount Rainier,
because mutual friends invited us on a hiking and camping trip at Itsip Creek, which is the Carbon Glacier area of Mount Rainier. I knew them through church. There used to be a LGBT mass at the Catholic Church at St. Joseph's before we were tossed out. And you knew them through work. And so they invited us both separately. And they were very interested in me meeting somebody else they knew. And I saw you, and I was very interested in finding out who you were.
And I do remember that meeting in the campground on that sunny August day. And I remember the hikes up to, it was Natural Bridge, I think, was the hike we went up to on that misty day.
So I knew you were interested when we got to the top. And in the mist, and you offered me peanut M&Ms, and you were a little nervous when you made the offer, so I thought, oh, there might be some energy here.
And then that's true. I was a little nervous. I really didn't know you at all and really hadn't had a chance to really talk with you since I hiked up the mountain with Kevin and you hiked up the mountain with Bob.
And then on the way back down, I asked you if you had a tent. You said no, but Kevin and Bob were going to provide you a tent. I said, my tent sleeps three people. You said, never mind.
Because I thought it was a setup.
Somehow, nothing happened, but we did spend the night together in that tent. And then I had to leave the next day, and I left you a note.
You left me a note, that's right, inviting me to see the movie Paris is Burning the next week. And so I think I called you. Did I call you the very next day?
Yeah, that Monday.
That next Monday, yeah. To go out on a date. And the one thing I do remember, though, is that you put me on hold. I couldn't believe it. Oh, my God, he put me on hold.
Because there were people in my office, and I thought, wow, he called Monday, so let me get these people out of the office. And so then we started dating.
And I think you realize that you're not linear. I'm very linear. You're much more a stream of consciousness. You're kind of all over the place. And I think one of the ways that it's demonstrated in your life is that, you know, you're the one that reads eight books all at once, which is something I could never do, where I need to read the book and finish it. So I am truly the linear one, but you truly are not.
The first thing that struck me when I saw Michael was how handsome he is. You know, with his black hair and his olive complexion and his really athletic body, he is incredibly gracious and even in his approach to things that life has tossed at us. So what attracted you to me? I forgot that since so long.
I think you know, it was, you know, that red hair that, you know, is a little less obvious today. That red hair, I think, you know, you're just kind of the ease of conversation. I could tell you were a very deep and thoughtful person from the first conversations that we had, either on the first or second date.
So, in other words, Michael brings a lot of stability and calm into my life, and I bring a lot of chaos and excitement into his.
I'd say that sums that up pretty
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray and his husband, Michael Shiosaki, recorded at StoryCorps in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood. In 1987, Gerald Hankerson was wrongfully convicted of aggravated murder. And after 22 years behind bars, Governor Chris Gregoire commuted Hankerson's life sentence. Gerald Hankerson described to Rachel DeCruz what life was like in solitary confinement.
It's a 6-by-9-inch cell, everything in there is cement. It's a little narrow window that you got to look, you got to stand on you sideways just to be able to put both, look out the window with both eyes. Otherwise, it's one eye at a time. Lights never go out. It's always on. And the only way you can communicate with people is through cracks in the wall who's next door. But you never get to see anybody except for maybe 1 hour a day. And this went on for quite a few years for me. You had one phone call and shower a day, depending on what prison you were at, depending on whether they give you once every 3 days or not. But it's literally like a kennel. And to sit there for so long and so you, and, you know, for so long, I didn't see a different color other than the color beige that I used to actually have people send me colorful pictures in an envelope so I could just put some color on my wall because my eyes were sensitive to things like blue and red and others. It felt like a hospital being there so long and seeing the same color. Any other color you see will actually hurt your eyes to adjust. Only things you had was to be able to read was like a Bible, other books. So I chose the Bible and the dictionary. And still to this day, I still don't know which one was is best. But ultimately, I read them both and learned a lot. And, of course, I remember the technique inside when you're on solitary confinement. If you stay up all night and sleep all day, time go by faster, especially when you know you're only going to be there for years rather than days or months. So, and at nighttime, and plus it's quieter. And I remember it was Willie Mock. We used to play chess. Now, neither one of us can see each other because there's a huge wall between us both, but we used to talk between the door. It's a lot easier to hear at night when everybody's really asleep. And, but I could never understand how to play this game because I ain't got a board. So,
yeah, or pieces.
You know, pieces or anything. Yeah. You know, I just looking at my reflection in the window as I call out my numbers. But he taught me how to draw a chessboard in your mind. 8 by 8, you got 64 squares. Each of you got 16 pieces, and all of the board is numbered. Now I'm able to pick numbers in my mind to know how to move across the chessboard. And playing mental chess and remembering not only my moves and his moves was probably one of the best moves, teachings that I've ever could have got, because it allowed me to structure my mind in a way to understand that how we maneuver and how we go through life is all, I mean, everything is specific and, you know, structured in a way to learn life. It was amazing. Like, who would have thought that I could learn how to play chess without even having a chessboard? It's all in the mind.
Yeah.
And I think that's where my strength helped me endure that crap. I'm the first man in the history of the state to ever walk out of prison after being sentenced to, for the rest of his life.
Tell me what you felt like on that day.
Oh, man, this is going to take a little longer. Man, you're going to need a couple extra minutes for this, because this was the big one. This is the one that, you know, I remember that I was sitting down at the table with my friend Barry Massey, who's the youngest man that's ever been convicted in the nation. He's finally coming home in February, by the way. Barry Massey.
That's fantastic.
And he's coming home in February. And, of course, we're sitting there, and my counselor come and tell me, she says, Gerald, you can't go to yard because it's workout time. It's like, the superintendent want to see you. And I was like, come on, man. Every time this happened, that means pack my bags and I'm out of here again. So I done actually started saying my byes to people. I went to my room. I grabbed my phone book. I gave a message to say, man, call my family, my number, just in case. I don't know what's about to happen. I know what that transition is about to be. No communication, no nothing. And they came and escorted me out to the office. He made all the guards get out of the office, comes in. He's sitting at the desk, and he got this yellow piece of paper and pink paper rolled up in his hand. And he says, Gerald, have a seat. And I've known him for years, even when he became a regular cop, an officer, moved up through the ranks at Monroe back when all this other stuff happened. So I was, Pat Gleeby is his name. And I was like, I'm not sitting down, Gleeby. But I know that I'm used to this routine by now, man. Just what I do this time and where am I headed? And he's like, sit down. I was like, no, we had this debate. And I said, I'm looking at the goldenrod paper in the back of your hand. That means the signature that signs me off to intensive management unit. And he just said, Gerald, I just want to be the first person that says you're a free man. And he rolled out my agreement signed by Governor Gregoire to grant me my clemency. And I'm just stunned. I sat down in a chair, and there were some books that was on the table that I knocked down. There was this phone in the middle of the table, and this is on April 9th, 2009. And he slides it to me, and he says, call whoever you want. And I was like, I had to call my lawyer, Cheryl McLeod, who to 3 years ago, became the newest Supreme Court judge in Washington State. That's Scotia. That's my girl. And as soon as I dialed that number, she said, Gerald, you're sitting down. I said, let's not go through this again. I already know, attorney. And she was, her whole office, you can hear me in the background screaming. She said, now what does it mean? I said, I don't know. Let's ask him. And when I handed him the phone, they were talking, and that's the first time I heard him say, oh, no, 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 we're not going through a process. I'm walking Gerald out of here tonight. And I say, let's go. He said, man, go pack your stuff, do all the stuff, the process. You know, people got to come take pictures and all of that. It was yard in. Everybody now coming back. He actually had to lock the prison down to walk me out of there because the whole prison had heard. Mm-hmm. And because too many, I mean, hugs and, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he said, get out of here for the news come. And sent me on my way. But ultimately, and my first call, the first call I got on my cell phone, on a cell phone that I've never seen in 20-some years,
yeah.
Last one was the size of suitcases. Now they got these little hand things. And it was Senator Debbie Rigala, retired from the Washington State Senate last couple years ago. But she's welcome home. I mean, it was a beautiful moment, a beautiful moment.
Gerald Hankerson, on his release from prison in 2009 after spending 22 years behind bars. Today, Gerald Hankerson is president of the NAACP's Seattle King County branch and the three-county conference that oversees Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. Coming up in a moment, more stories from StoryCorps at New Holly. Listening to StoryCorps at Seattle's New Holly neighborhood. 20-some years ago, Mary Lou Balazone decided to become a foster parent. So she adopted two foster kids, Kayla and Kayla's brother, Dustin. Today, Kayla is 26, Mary Lou is 57. They talked about how they became a family at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood.
Hello, my name is Kayla. I am 26 years old, and my interviewer is my mother, Mary Lou.
And I'm Mary Lou Balazone. I'm 57, and I'm going to be asking my daughter questions. So today we came to talk about how our family was formed, which is a little different. Kayla was adopted. Kayla and her brother are both adopted, and it was a special kind of adoption called foster care adoption. And foster care adoption means that a child comes to live with a foster parent that is willing to adopt them if they become legally free.
So, Mom, what made you decide you wanted to adopt kids?
I did want to have children in my life. I wasn't married. Didn't look like I was going to get married anytime soon. And I thought, I don't want to have birth children that I bring into this world when there's so many kids that need a family. And I also wanted to support what I thought was a better way for foster care.
Now, you adopted Dustin and I together. Did you think you would have more than one child before we both came along?
No. So I often would tease people and say, you know, really, you shouldn't be outnumbered by the number of kids you have. So if you're a single parent, two is probably a little more difficult. Well, luckily for me, you and Dustin were the first ones they called about. And of course I said, oh, yeah. Because the first time you came with me, I thought it was just going to be for the weekend. And I got the call on Thursday and I came and picked you up on Friday, you and Dustin up on Friday at the Department of Social and Health Services. Do you remember that?
I do remember. I remember feeling very shy and unsure why we were moving from home to home. But I also... felt the need to impress you so that hopefully I would stay with you. I was 4.5 years old when this first happened.
And Dustin was 18 months. And I have a very clear memory of coming to pick you guys up because you were playing on this little slide thing. And you both were the cutest little things with your blonde hair and your cute little cheeks. And I have to say, at that very first moment, I thought, oh, these are my Balasone kids. In that time, how did you understand what was happening to you and Dustin?
I don't think I really understood what it meant until I was in about middle school. I think I just kept repeating what the adults around me were telling me. It took me, you know, many years to figure out really what foster care and adoption was, even after I was adopted. And when I came to realize that, it still took me years to process what was wrong with the life Dustin and I had before entering foster care. You know, I think I felt like it was normal or okay to be abusive towards children, and I don't think I totally understood, you know, why. Because, of course, she told me all the time, you know, that she loved me and everything like that. And I guess I didn't realize that actions and words are very different things at that young age. And that it takes a lot more than just loving somebody to be a parent to somebody. Those separate things, you know, because it's very separate. You know, loving somebody and being able to take care of them are very different. And I don't think I really knew what that meant until that. You remember that project I did where I had to take care of that baby in middle school in eighth grade? And I failed it the first time around because I didn't wake up when it would cry in the middle of the night. And so I had to do the project and keep that baby all over again. I think that was the first time I really realized that it took more than just wanting to be a parent and having a child to be a parent.
It's interesting that you felt like you weren't loved by her because I think she showed most of her attention to you. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, but about a year into you living with me, Annette approached her social worker and said that she was willing to let me adopt Dustin, but that she wanted you back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I probably should have told you this before we started. Do you want me to change the subject?
No, it's okay.
But I said no. And I said no because Dustin was the person that had been in your life the longest.
And he's my best friend.
And, you know, you used to kind of take care of him when he was a little boy. And, you know, he had some hard times, too, because it wasn't a good situation for him.
I have no idea how grateful I am that you said no. Because we probably wouldn't have been together.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's, you know, sometimes people ask me would I do it again, and I'm like, I can't imagine my life without my children. Of course I would do it again. It's like when the judge asked me, do you understand what you're taking on? I'm like, well, yeah. This is my family. These are my kids. And I'm glad we did this today.
Me too.
Yeah, because it's some things we hadn't talked about before. Some things we have.
Some things we have.
Yeah.
Love you, Mom.
Love you, sweetie.
Mary Lou Balasone and her daughter, Kayla Balasone, about how they became a family. Mary Lou and Kayla talked to each other at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood last summer. Our next interview is a Garfield High School teacher who leads a nationwide movement against high-stakes testing, speaking with his mother, who teaches at the University of Washington, where she's trying to organize professors into a union.
My name is Jesse Hagopian. I'm 36 years old. And I'm here with my mom.
And my name is Amy Hagopian, and I'm 59 years old. And we're in Seattle, Washington, and I am with my son, Jesse Hagopian.
This is a pretty awesome opportunity to get to ask you questions about how we became who we are. You know, this being the 100th anniversary of the genocide that happened in Armenia, I think that's an important thing to reflect on to figure out who we are today. Given that my great-grandfather, Ardash, escaped the genocide and came to the United States. And I wanted to ask you more about that, how that experience may have shaped our family being more activists and socially conscious and active.
Yes. So my grandfather was actually away from Armenia when the genocide started, but he lost his wife and children to that genocide. And as you know, the Ottoman Turks marched the women and children on death marches. That's my understanding of how they died, although much of the story is a bit lost to obscurity. I wish they had had a story corps.
Right. And so I could see why now, today, you have studied war in depth and try to bring that understanding to your students at the University of Washington. You think probably relates back to the fact that war so deeply impacted our family's history. And I think one of the stories I remember about the ways war impacted our family that I would like to know more about is with your dad, John Hagopian, having been a vet in World War II. I know I've heard stories that John was in the Navy and that he was on one of the ships that reached Japan soon after the dropping of the bombs.
So he was in the Signal Corps, not the Navy, where he worked with the Morse code and that sort of thing. He operated the switchboard for General MacArthur during the occupation of Japan. But they were on a boat coming from New Guinea to Japan when the bomb dropped. And they thought they were on their way to invade Japan, but they were actually on their way to occupy Japan. And I think because the Signal Corps tended to attract a different sort of person than the mainstream service branches, these guys on the ship were really angry about the dropping of the bomb, and they realized what the consequences would be, both for the populations and for the world in general, that we now became the only country in the world that dropped an atomic bomb.
It's shameful.
And they were so angry, they tore the American flag down from the ship. And,
wow.
When my father told me that story, it was the first time I had seen him cry. And when he came home from the war, he became part of a group that started in Detroit called GIs Against the Bomb. And so we've always been an anti-war family. So now you've encountered trauma in your life, despite being just a young person. You were in Haiti when the earthquake happened. Now, that's not a war, but it's a very interesting country in the sense that it has been at war and it has been occupied and it has a very interesting history. And all of that sort of erupted as part of the earthquake. So tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I traveled to Haiti 2 days before the earthquake hit. I went to Haiti with Sarah, my wife, and my one-year-old son at the time, Miles. One of the things that made that experience so difficult was knowing that we did everything we could to help, but the most powerful forces in the world didn't. In the aftermath of the earthquake, Sarah and I teamed up with an EMT who happened to be a guest at the hotel, and we worked for several days bandaging badly injured Haitians who were flocking to the hotel because the hospital in the area had been destroyed and this was the only medical care available. And so we just ripped the bed sheets up into strips and we used them as bandages and tied tourniquets and broke the chairs apart to use as splints. And we just threw ourselves into trying to help as many people as we could. And then on the third day after the earthquake, we went down to downtown Port-au-Prince with a friend of ours. And we saw UN forces and US forces setting up checkpoints and barbed wire and fences while ordinary Haitians were scrambling over piles of rubble trying to dig their loved ones out with no help. There was no food being passed out. There was no help from official capacities to dig people out. And so, we learned later that 300,000 people died, possibly. The count is very poorly known or 300,000 injured, but tens of thousands of those people were alive after the earthquake but trapped under the rubble. And to see hundreds of bodies lining the streets, and the only help that we saw from the government was scooping up dead bodies and putting them in the back of Mack trucks. That was something that I'll never be able to get out of my head, and something that motivates me today very deeply, to know that we have to have a different kind of government. We have to have a different kind of social system, that when people are at their greatest need, we would organize our resources to help them rather than to vilify them or to see them as a possible threat and set up checkpoints or barbed wire.
Jesse Hagopian, Garfield High School teacher and a leader in the national movement against high-stakes testing. And you also heard his mother, Amy Hagopian, who teaches at the University of Washington. She's trying to form a union among UW professors. They recorded themselves last summer at the StoryCorps booth in the New Holly neighborhood of Seattle. Next, a story from one of Seattle's best-known activists.
Hello, my name is Luz Viminda Uzuri Carpenter. I also go by Lulu Carpenter. I am 37 years old. My relationship to my interviewee is that he is my chosen uncle as well as one of my mentors.
My name is Bob Santos. My age is 81 and a half.
What was your role in the International District?
Well,
as a young person.
My first role, of course, Lulu was growing up. And my father joined the U.S. Navy in the Philippines in 1919. And as he got close to shore here in San Diego, he got in a little fight with a junior officer. And before they docked, or as they were docking, somehow he jumped ship. And he had no skills, but he liked to fight. So he became a professional prize fighter. And he changed his name because the shore patrol, the military security people were looking for him. He changed his name from Macario Santos to Sammy Santos. So he became a professional prize fighter. He started his career, did very well there. He reached the main event status. The shore patrol finally caught him. He was put in the brig. And when he came out, he traveled the West Coast, but decided that the Pacific Northwest was also a good fight town. So he traveled and settled here in Seattle. Dad became a local hero as the prize fighter that represented Seattle. And, of course, being Filipino, he became a hero in our community. Growing up in the International District was, we're talking about, my memory is into the 40s. My mother passed away in 1935, so I started living with my father. And in 1945, he lost his eyesight due to boxing injuries, so I became his seeing eye dog. So I would bring him around to all his favorite places that he used to hang out. Our neighborhood used to be called Chinatown, but we also had a Manila town and a Japan town called Nihomachi. And the Manila town was right in the center of Chinatown. So I would bring my dad around to all the barber shops, all the little gambling halls. I used to love doing that because the winners in all the barber shops and the gambling houses, of course, they used to gamble, which was illegal in the state of Washington. But all the winners, when I'd bring my dad to these establishments, would give me a dime, a nickel or a dime, but the winners would, and they'd give my dad a cigar. So I used to bring dad everywhere. We stopped at all the barber shops, all the gambling halls, all the establishments. And then I attended parochial school. So I lived with an aunt and uncle during the weekday as I went to school. I became an altar boy. Okay, well, that's cool. You know, you're an altar boy. You follow that religion, and so weekdays I'd be at school. I'd be at the Immaculate Conception Grade School, elementary school, and in the evenings and weekends I'd be with my dad in the heart of Chinatown International District, with the gamblers and the bootleggers and the hustlers and the ladies of the evening. Our room was in the NP Hotel in Seattle at 6th and between Jackson Street and Main Street. And about every once in a while, maybe once a month, Dad would have a little party in our room. Our hotel room was where we lived was a SRU, a single room occupancy unit, and it was 9 by 13, so it was a small room.
But
our little party would move out into the hallway. Mm. And so Julian, the Filipino head of the commissary at Pier 91, the naval station, would bring the food. Danny, the bootlegger, he would either come and bring the whiskey or he would send the whiskey up. A couple of the old Filipino prize fighters would show up, and they were all dressed up in their mm-hmm. suits and ties because this was a special event for them. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't have very much of a social life. And then two ladies would show up, Marge, the redhead, mm-hmm. and Dixie, the blonde. Two white ladies, very young, and they were the house professionals. You don't have to read beyond that. But they mm-hmm. worked. They worked the buildings. They worked especially the NP Hotel, and they would come in. They must have been in their early 20s, and all of a sudden, I knew something was happening to me, right? Because I was falling in love with these older women. They came in. They were all made up. They were beautiful, mm-hmm. and they had this. They wore perfume and. They pat me on the head and say, yeah. Oh, Bobby, you're growing. I remembered you when you were a little kid 2 years ago, right? Uh-huh. And so I was conflicted because here I am a Catholic boy. And, you know, when you're a Catholic, everything that mm-hmm. was fun was a sin. let me say that, you know. Okay. Maybe a venial sin, but yeah. everything was a sin. So I'm with this environment, and mm-hmm. I'm really enjoying myself, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing personal, but mm-hmm. because you're growing up with a different kind of element that you don't learn in a parochial school. You mm-hmm. know, Peter was a saint, and James was a saint, and there's Mary Magdalene, and all these folks like that. And then you had Dixie, and you had Marge, and you had Julian, the commissary guy, and they had the gamblers. And so I was having fun at one period of my life, and then the next day, Monday, I'd be at school, and I'm thinking, gee, I better go to confession because I'm having all these thoughts.
Longtime Seattle activist Bob Santos talking with Lulu Carpenter at the StoryCorps booth in New Holly last summer. Our Stories from New Holly continues after this short break. Conversation about death and address.
My name is Dorothy Bullitt. I am 59 years old, and my relationship to Mary Merriweather is she is my friend, and she is the mother of my late partner, Patrick Burr.
My name is Mary Merriweather. I'm 79 years old, and Dorothy Bullitt is a very good friend of mine. She was a girlfriend to my dead son. From high school. They were friends from high school. Patrick died from prostate cancer. And he died because he didn't have any medical insurance. And so he didn't catch it early. Mm-hmm. And then he suffered so much at the end. Even though he was under the care of hospice, he had a terrible death. And I watched it. I mean, I was there with him, and it was just so painful.
Throughout that time, you were enjoying music, and you both loved to dance and to sing.
Oh.
And even when he was so sick, he was singing and dancing and laughing.
Right. We had this little thing. We never talked about it, but I would say something, and then it might be the words to a song, and then he would start singing the song, you know. And for instance, there was one day when the nurse came to change his the catheter mm-hmm. in the bag. Mm-hmm. And so after the nurse left, and I was sitting in the living room, he came walking down the hall, and he was singing and patting on the bag, and he was singing, "Papa's got a brand new bag." And that was the way he was. That was the humor, you know. Yes. And so where it was hard times, he kept me laughing. We had a lot. We laughed about a lot. And then it was the day with you in the dress.
Oh,
that
yeah.
I was there.
The Cinderella dress.
Right.
When he was holding me around my waist. And we had been listening to music. And he felt my waist and said, "I think you could fit into my Cinderella dress." "Your Cinderella dress?" He said, "Yes. When I was 28, and he was 58, when I was 28, I found this dress in an antique store, and I thought, I want to buy that dress, and one day a woman will fit it, and she will be my Cinderella." And many women tried, and no one fitted it. Okay. And so he got up, and he walked across the room with his catheter bag on the pole, and he pulled out of his teeny little closet a bag covering a dress, and he said, "Go into the bathroom and try it on." And I'm thinking, oh, no, I'm 56 years old. This is not going to have a good outcome. And then I came out, and it fit perfectly.
Right. And I just couldn't believe it.
And that he says, "Dorothy, when you preside at my funeral,
yes,
I want you to wear this dress." And I said, "A black sequined beaded cocktail dress? Isn't that going to be a bit much for your funeral?" And he said, "It's a black funeral. You can't overdress." He said, "But there may be women in the audience who have tried that dress on."
Right.
And I remember when I talked about it in the funeral.
At the funeral, right.
And his wife, or his partner, former partner, yeah, jumped up and said, "I wore that dress." And he was so just full of romantic gestures and playfulness, even
right,
as he was so very sick. And having rekindled that relationship, he was so different. And the life he'd led was so different from the men that I had been with or had expected to be with. And one thing I learned is being with a man who really loves his mother and really likes his mother and really enjoys his mother's humor and her company, that is a great, great recipe for a partner.
That was Dorothy Bullitt and Mary Merriweather speaking at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle last summer. Our final conversation from the StoryCorps booth in New Holly in Seattle is how a day of berry picking changed a boy's life.
My name is Lala Andrea Seguro. I am 22 years old, and I'm here with my dad, Nemo.
Yeah, I'm Nemo Seguro. I'm 52 years old. I was born in Seattle, Washington, and just sharing a story about my childhood with my daughter. Back when I was young, and Boeing was where your grandmother went to work straight out of high school. She worked in the factory there, and there was a big layoff. And then there was actually a big billboard up that said, "Last person leaving Seattle, please turn out the lights." People were going through some pretty hard times. And your grandmother went through some retraining, and she ended up landing a job at the Veterans Administration in downtown. So we were pretty excited, like she got a job, and finally we're going to see some money rolling in. But things were really tight. And my mother had never worked in an office before, and she went to work one day. Everybody said, "Wait, we're going to take a coworker out for her birthday." My mother was like, "Oh, okay," and sort of went along and didn't realize that she wasn't just responsible for her own lunch, but also the part of the lunch for the birthday girl and part of the present and the card and everything. Her boss said, oh, it's okay, just write me a check," which my mother, too embarrassed to say what her situation was, ended up writing the check. So that afternoon, she snuck into a conference room and made some calls. She had seen kids downtown that were going off to pick berries off on the islands. So she came home that night and said, look, you got to be downtown, down in Pioneer Square at like 7 in the morning, and you go off, and it's going to be great. There's going to be all these other kids around, and they're going to give you a lunch. So next day, I woke up. I was used to, you know, getting up early. I walked, you know, the length of the hill down through Chinatown, made it to Pioneer Square, and showed up at the place I was supposed to be at, 2nd and Yesler, next to the Smith Tower. You can't miss it, but there's no kids there. There's a bunch of these Indian guys hanging out.
How old were you?
Maybe 5th grade. I'd already been coached on what to say, how old I was, because I was too young. So while we're waiting there, these guys are all talking, and some more Indians show up, Indian families, you know, and with some small kids. They were like asking, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm going to pick berries. They said, okay, we'll just, you know, follow our lead kind of thing. They warned me, these guys are really mean. Don't talk on the bus. Don't talk unless you're spoken to. So we were all lined up in this old jalopy of a school bus, pulled up. And so everybody, but they got to me, this only white face in the crowd is like, asked me how old I was, and I lied. And they, well, what grade are you in? Because they didn't believe me, and I lied. And what year were you born? Lied again. And this one woman spoke up, said, you know, I'm friends with this mom, just mentioned some name that she, you know, I just nodded in agreement, and, you know, was like, well, he's with us kind of thing. And so, you know, have you ever picked before? And I was like, yeah, and I really never had. So we get on this bus. Everything was quiet. Like, they had warned me, like, there's no talking. These guys are mean. They want silence, you know. And this was a sort of joyous group, laughing, joking, kids making a little noise. But when we got on the bus, everyone was quiet. We drove across West Seattle. We went down to the Fauntleroy Ferry. I was kind of excited. I didn't get a ride on the ferry but a few times in my life up to that point. So we took the ferry over and got the Vashon. And then we end up in this field, and they open the doors, and, like, everybody out. We start getting out. They start handing us big wood flats. And I could only carry, like, one or two. They show me where my row is, and I started picking. And I was, it's not easy, especially when you're a kid. You think with the little hands you'd be good at it. But I was hungry. The sun was starting to come up. And so a few of the berries would go into the containers inside the wood flat. And a few would go in my mouth, and then, you know, a few more in the, and then pretty soon they're going right into my mouth. And I, all of a sudden, I get hit by a rock, a small rock. And I looked around, and this older Indian guy, he shook his head at me. And I knew he meant don't eat the berries, so I continued picking. But when he wasn't looking, I started eating again. I didn't know he had seen me, and he kind of crouched and he scooted over, like watching for the overseer to make sure he didn't get caught. But he came over to me, and he picked up a few pebbles. He put them in his mouth, swished them around his mouth, and he spit out the dirt. And he said, see? And then he hands me these pebbles. So I pop in my mouth, and I wanted to immediately spit them out, but I ended up following his lead, and I split out this dirty saliva. And he said, he goes, that will help with the hunger and with the thirst. And then the overseer sees, and he yells at him, hey, what are you doing? He's, I'm just showing this kid how to pick the good ones, boss. He'd give me encouraging looks, and he was a fast picker, and he had already gone off to get more flats. And I don't even think I got through one flat when they yelled out, you know, it's lunch, right? And I'm like, awesome, right? Lunch. And, you know, I spit out these stones and make my way over to the bus, and I'm like, all the just Indian people, they went off into this grove where the little ones were being watched, and I'm looking around for where's the lunch, and I see them like breaking out food, like breaking out bread and ripping off hunks and passing around water, and there's no lunch being provided. It's whatever they're able to pull out. I kind of went over and found a shady tree. They were sitting in the grass in the shade, and I went off to the side, and they're like, hey, you know, they start calling me over, come on over. It's really embarrassed, but I went over there, and they welcomed me into the circle, and they handed me something to drink and gave me food and, you know, make sure he gets some of that. And they started asking me, you know, what are you doing here? And you know, this is like the worst place, you know, to pick. And, And I didn't realize that when my mother had been calling around, you know your grandmother now. She's older, a little scatterbrained, but she totally, like, blew it. She, instead of tossing this particular company, she, for some weird reason, that's the one she gave me, and all the other ones I didn't go to, with the lunch and the kids and the fun, as they promised her on the phone. But ended up with these people, and we're just sitting around. And so it turned out I was at a farm where people were coming out of homeless shelters and people that were sleeping on the streets, that this was one of the places that would take them, but they were paying them less for each flat than you'd get at the other farms because they could do that to them and they could treat them poorly and yell at them.
Do you remember what your response was when you found that out?
I freaked out because I realized, I had barely picked any, and I got real upset. And a woman, it was the same woman who sort of took me under when we were downtown. And it was like, what's wrong? And I said, I need so much money. I need to pick so many flats. And now I'm just trying to figure out how many more I'd have to pick because we were getting paid less. And they were like, why do you need this money? And I explained my mom's situation and, that we were poor. And I just kind of opened up to them. And they weren't judging. They were like, all right, it's going to be okay. It's going to be, they were making sure that I knew it was going to be okay. We'll figure something out. So the overseers came back and then yelled at us to get back to work. So I go back to the line and I got my box next to me, and somebody came by and dumped a bunch of berries in there.
Oh.
And so it made me kind of pick up the pace. I realized people were, like, I had a team behind me. And I brought my first flat in and they were like, this isn't like full enough. And somebody else was in line and they said, well, here, take some, and they spread it out to make it a kind of a full thing. It's almost bringing me to tears thinking about it because it was such great gestures on their part.
What did you feel like when you saw these people that you didn't know helping you?
It was strange because I felt sorry for them when I saw them downtown and when I knew their situation. They were talking about where they slept outdoors and it was kind of cold, and I was like pitying their situation. And here are these people that had nothing, literally, and were just making subsistence money, were like taking care of me. The embarrassment faded quickly. I was honored that I was brought into the group and looked over by people that other people ignore on the streets. Mm. And people, I'd been running around as like a little street brat on Beacon Hill in Chinatown and just really never noticed these people. I ended up not only meeting my mother's required quota, but they helped me exceed it.
Mm.
My mother had said, whatever you make over this, you can keep. And it was her incentive, and you're not just doing this to cover this woman's present and card, you know what I mean? Because that's what I was doing. But on the bus ride home, it was a little more exuberant. And everyone, got off and had some money, and they invited me to go along. And I was like, no, I have to get this money home, kind of thing. I didn't know that the banks were closed or my mom, I thought she needed it right away. And I was able to take the bus home, which was nice because it's all uphill from Pioneer Square up to Beacon Hill. It kind of changed my feeling about the situation that your grandmother was in, or that we were in collectively. It was like I had a different perspective of our poverty in relationship to these people that had helped us with what we went through. So when I got home, she asked me how it was. I really didn't like it. It was hard work. The men were mean that were the overseers, but I didn't want her to feel real bad about it. And I said it was okay. I kind of put a good spin on it and told her how, people fed me and how they were nice to me and they were kids. But I made it sound too good and try not to make her feel bad. She said, well, that's great. Then you can go back tomorrow. And I was like, Yeah, that's when I kind of broke down and said it was awful and the men were mean. And I kind of told her more of the story. But she said, well, the people were nice, but we were in such a situation that, you know, she thought that it was, you know, a sacrifice I could occasionally make. I'll never forget what those people did for me. It's guided me on how I treat people. And
did your experience at the Berry Farm change the way you treated your own mother?
It made me more understanding of the situation that she was in, and that we didn't really have that network of support that these people did, that they came together and they sat down and shared food. And my mother, who came out of a, you know, I'd say a middle or upper middle class family in Ballard, you know, Scandinavian neighborhood, to find herself raising kids on her own in the projects and public housing of South Seattle, where it was kind of looked down upon because of all the different minority groups that we lived around. We were teased a lot about it, that it's like people abandoned her. And I realized that if we were going to have anyone supporting us, it wasn't going to be our family members with means or former friends with means, that we were sort of in this with our neighbors and the people that were around us that were in the same situation.
Nemo Sayeru told that story at New Holly last summer. For more StoryCorps at New Holly conversations, go to KUOW.org and search for StoryCorps. I'm your producer, Ross Reynolds. If you have any questions or comments, write to me. It's rar@kuow.org, rar@kuow.org. Thanks for listening. Thank you.